Well, I know that the way we started off services with singing and not having the music was a technical glitch, but I kind of liked it. It was neat because what I noticed is that without the music, everyone sang a little louder and there was just kind of this cohesion and harmony. And that was neat. You know, maybe we should mess up once in a while, you know, kind of do that more often, you know, oops, sort of thing. So, but I enjoyed that. That was neat to hear everyone's voices united like that. Well, brethren, today I'm going to be speaking about an individual who changed his life. You know, many times we talk about our lives and we talk about differences and how we come into this world. Some people come in with seemingly everything handed to them, health, money, talent, skills, and others are not. Others are born into poverty and discomfort, and struggle and trial, you know, disabilities, impairments. And I always referred to it, you know, as a kid, and the way it was taught to me was, well, you know, that's just the hand that you're dealt. You know, that's, no child gets to choose how they're born, where they're coming from. And that's true. And one of the things that I think that as we look at the Bible is that God has a way of evening out things. He has a way of working with us so that the hand that we are dealt is not the hand that we end up with in the end. I think that oftentimes those who are seemingly dealt that perfect hand, that royal flush, have everything to lose. And yet those who are maybe handed out that hand that maybe just has a pair of twos, and twos aren't wild, you know, they have everything to gain because they're starting with so little and all they have is the potential to grow. And as they turn and look towards God, God has a way of developing those cards, those talents, those gifts, those experiences that we all live through and grow into a winning hand. A hand that is not there to beat anyone else, but that is there to show us our entrance into God's family and into His kingdom. Today I want to talk about a man whose name literally means whom God sets free. Now, when you think of that name, whom God sets free, that means that he wasn't born with the silver spoon in his mouth, but that he was born under some sort of oppression, some sort of bondage, some sort of slavery. His name is Jephthah. Now, of course, many of you will already know who he is, but I want to take a look at his life, his story, and not just picking out little bits and pieces, but actually looking at this man whom God set free, whom, with God's help, was able to take the hand that he was dealt and turn it into something else, turn it into a story that we can all look at as encouragement, as guidance, and as hope. Because that hope, the man who is discussed in Judges, is also discussed in Hebrews 11 amongst those heroes of faith. So let's take a look at Jephthah and turn to Judges. Judges chapter 11. Jephthah was the ninth judge of Israel during the time of Judges, before the time of the kings. And as I said, he didn't start out quite as well as some of the others. Now Jephthah, the Gileadite, was a mighty man of valor. And I love this, because it says, but he was the son of a harlot. And Gilead begat Jephthah. Now, some commentaries will wonder about this, because his father is not specifically named here. We don't have, you know, his father's name is Jim, the son of Bob of Gilead. We just have him given a name which could almost be a title. Gilead begat Jephthah. You know, I want to say one thing before I get too deeply into this. I'm going to be making commentary on Jephthah's life, and I'll refer to other commentaries as and individuals who make commentary on him. But a lot of this is trying to read the story of Jephthah, read any of the stories in the Bible, and to interpret. Because a lot of things are not specifically spelled out for us. So all we can do is try to study and understand what life was like at that time, and to make interpretations about how God was using people and why. However, this is Jephthah, according to Dave, not, and how I believe that God used him and how his life was. So, as we look at who Jephthah was, who he was, the family that he was born into, Gilead, as a name, is not specific to who his father was. However, if you know some things about history, oftentimes a ruler or a ruling family was given the name of the place where they were ruling, like York in English history. This son of York, well, that was also the area where they were. It was not actually their family name. But when they were referred to by other leaders, by kings, they just called them York. So, for instance, if you ruled New York, they wouldn't call you Dave, who rules New York. They'd say, hey, New York. Now, of course, this is my interpretation, and that kind of simplifies it, makes it a little redneck. But this is also one of the interpretations for who his father was. It was not just that he was Gilead, but that is the tribe that he was from, and that he was a leader of that tribe. So much so that that's how they just referred to him as. And he begot Jephthah, but his mother was a harlot. Now Gilead's wife bore sons. And when his wife's sons grew up, they drove Jephthah out and said to him, you shall have no inheritance in our father's house, for you are the son of another woman. So this is the hand that is dealt to Jephthah. He didn't ask to be born into the family the way that he was. Now again, we don't know for sure if his mother was actually a harlot or if this was a derogatory term because she was taken as a concubine and not actually considered to be one of the married wives. But this man was in a position where he could have more than one wife. He could support multiple sons and daughters. And Gilead grew up kind of being the outcast. Now, it's also possible that he was the firstborn of his father's lineage. Because the sons are saying, oh no, you're not getting the inheritance. And they drove him out. So, either way, he was considered to be illegitimate, even though he grew up in that household. And we can only speculate what life must have been like. We can look at other examples in the Bible of men who had multiple wives and the problems that came from it. Because while God does not expressly condemn it as sin, it is not, however, the way that God intended it to be. God created Adam and Eve. Two, we're told to cleave one unto another. Even Solomon, who had multiple wives, in the end, in Ecclesiastes, says, don't forget the wife of your youth. Don't seek after others, because it's damaging. So we know that within those families, there was struggles with hierarchy, issues of one feeling superior to the other. Even in Abraham's own family with his sons, there were problems. So this is the family that Jephthah grew up in, probably always being told that, well, you know, your mother's a harlot. And even though dad may keep you around, you're not really worth anything. We don't really want you here. In verse 3, then Jephthah fled from his brothers and dwelt in the land of Tob. Now Tob, the word actually means good. He dwelt in a good land, probably prosperous. However, it was also a border region. And it says, and worthless men banded together with Jephthah and went out raiding with him. Now, again, this is written by historians who anyone who writes tends to put their own little slant on it, just like I'm giving a sermon and you're hearing it from me and I've got my perspective that's different than others. However, Jephthah was exiled. He was cast out. He was disinherited and driven away. So already he's hurting. This isn't the home where he grew up. And maybe he's going to the land where his mother was from. We're not actually told. But he fled in the face of his brothers, and he's kind of hiding out. However, he gets these men who gather around him and says that they went out with him. And this, to go out, carries a military connotation, a verb meaning also to march. So Jephthah, just because of where he's at, men gather around him. They're probably drawn just to who he is as an individual. And during this time, maybe this time as I would think of it as an outcast out in the wilderness, Jephthah has experiences. He grows, not only just from learning how to survive, but learning how to lead men, learning how to fight, how to be brave in the face of danger. He's learning stamina and endurance. He learned the arts of war, of the military. And of course, during that time, Jephthah probably didn't know it, but he was being trained. All of these things that he was learning, God was going to someday use, even though at that time, Jephthah probably didn't see it. Many commentaries refer to Jephthah as nothing more than a pirate or a brigand, a highwayman leading his men. Again, that's one of the references to worthless men. However, we also know that he was considered a mighty man of valor. David, King David, also had mighty men of valor who were sometimes referred to as worthless. He gathered men together who were landless, kingless, who were social outcasts. And together, they came together and formed a band. Because just like Jephthah, David had something about him that held them together, that allowed them to see him as a leader, someone that they wanted to follow. And maybe it was the fact that he was a godly man, or maybe in some of their cases it was just because, wow, he really knows how to fight. And like mercenaries, you want to be on the winning side, because losing is not very profitable. So they would have been looked on as those dirty, worthless men. Now, it's also not said that they were attacking Israelites. They were in a border region with the Ammonites. And it's speculated that probably what they were doing was raiding Ammonite settlements, other kingdoms. And some people have referred to him almost as as an Israeli Robin Hood, leading his band of merry men, stealing from those bad Amorites and bringing it back to Israel. However, whatever it was, he was also gaining fame. Word of him was spreading. People knew who he was. They knew how successful he was. He was gaining fame. In verse 4, it came to pass after a time that the people of Ammon made war against Israel. And so it was, when the people of Ammon made war against Israel, that the elders of Gilead went to get Jephthah from the land of Tob. Then they said to Jephthah, "Come and be our commander, that we may fight against the people of Ammon." So Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, "Do you not hate me? Or did you not hate me and expel me from my father's house? Why have you come to me now when you are in distress?" You know, can you imagine what that must have been like for him? He's been cast out of his home, driven out of his country, away from all that he knew, his family. He is the ultimate black sheep. You're not wanted here. And so he goes off and survives. He learns how to become this mighty man of valor. And then all of a sudden, the family back home's in trouble. They're like, "Who's going to save us? Who's tough enough, strong enough, brave enough to save us in our hour of need?" And they come to him. How hard must it have been for him not to tell them no? You know, most of us, I think, would be sore pressed to say, "No, you didn't want me then, so I'm not coming now. Obviously, you've never loved me. And the only reason you want me now is because you're scared and you think I'm going to save you." I can tell you that's what I would think. That's how I would feel. "Really? Oh, sure, I wasn't good enough for you then, but now all of a sudden you want me." That's a human reaction. And yet, that's not exactly the way that Jephthah responds. So Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, verse 8, "And then the elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, 'That is why we have turned again to you now, that you may go with us and fight against the people of Ammon and be our head over the inhabitants of Gilead.'" So now they're not just saying, "Come back and save us." They're saying, "If you'll come back, not only will you be welcome back in Gilead, but we're going to make you our leader. You'll be the head of our tribe. We'll look to you for guidance." So Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, "If you take me back home to fight against the people of Ammon and the Lord delivers them to me, shall I be your head?" He's asking them, you really know what you're asking for. You're not going to bring me back, I'll save you, and then you'll stab me in the back. This is for real. This is true. And the elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, "The Lord will be a witness between us if we do not according to your words." Again, here's what will later on again be noted as, here's a vow that's made in the life of Jephthah. Then Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head and commander over them. And Jephthah spoke all his words before the Lord in Mizpah. Now, most commentaries will state that at this point, Jephthah is seeking God's guidance, not only before he officially accepts this position, but during the whole process. He's coming before God and saying, "Should I do this? Is this really what you want me to do? How do I come back into this position? How do I forgive them? How do I lead them? Is this really what you want me to do, God?" And then he takes his vow, he takes those promises, he takes that position in front of God. Now Jephthah sent messengers to the king of the people of Ammon, saying, "What do you have against me that you have come to fight against me in my land?" Now this is a rather telling statement, because he doesn't say, "Why have you come against Gilead?" I think this backs up the first point in chapter or in verse 1, that Jephthah, like his father, has taken the name of Gilead. He has taken that position as the head. And it's not just the land, but that they have come against him. It is personal. He is his tribe. And the king of the people of Ammon answered the messengers of Jephthah, "Because Israel took away my land when they came up out of Egypt, from the Arnon as far as the Jabbok, and to the Jordan. Now therefore restore those lands peaceably." So he's making a demand. "You give me what I want, or I'm going to bring my army against you." Now, of course, this is something that has happened throughout history. People see something that they want, and they try to take it. You know, what pops into my head was the original conflict back in, I think, 90 and 91, Desert Storm, Desert Shield, when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. And he made the excuse that, well, you know, my empire thousands of years ago used to include that. So I'm just taking back that which somebody else stole away from me. Leaders have done that ever since time began. But Jephthah shows something here. He's not just an illegitimate cast out. He's an ambassador. He is gifted and skilled in history. So Jephthah again sent messengers to the king of the people of Ammon and said to him, "Thus says Jephthah, Israel did not take away the land of Moab, nor the land of the people of Ammon. For when Israel came up out of Egypt, they walked through the wilderness as far as the Red Sea and came to Kadesh. Then Israel sent messengers to the kings of Edom, saying, 'Please let me pass through your land.' But the king of Edom would not heed, and in like manner they sent to the king of Moab, and he would not consent to Israel, would not consent. So Israel remained in Kadesh. And they went along through the wilderness and bypassed the land of Edom and the land of Moab, came to the east side of the land of Moab, and encamped on the other side of the Arnon. But they did not enter the border of Moab, for the Arnon was the border of Moab." So they respected this. They asked, you know, because it's the shortest route to be able to pass through these countries. And this was denied. So instead of going to war against them, they said, "Okay, we're going to take the long way around. We're not going to invade. We're not going to make war. We want to keep peace." Then Israel sent messengers to Sihon, king of the Amorites, king of Heshbon. And Israel said to him, "Please let us pass through your land into our place." And Sihon did not trust Israel to pass through his territory. So Sihon gathered all his people together, encamped in Jahaz, and fought against Israel. And the Lord God of Israel delivered Sihon and all his people into the hand of Israel, and they defeated them. Thus Israel gained possession of all the land of the Amorites who inhabited that country. They took possession of all the territory of the Amorites, from the Arnon to the Jabbok, and from the wilderness to the Jordan. And now the Lord God of Israel has dispossessed the Amorites from before his people Israel. Should you then possess it? He's letting them know that, first off, we didn't invade that country and try to take it. We just wanted to pass through it on our way to the Promised Land. But you weren't going to have it. Or that king, Sihon, wasn't going to have it. So he attacked. And our God delivered him and all his people into our hand, so that that land became ours. God gave it to us. It was never even yours in the first place. Verse 24, Will you not possess whatever Chemosh your God gives to you to possess? It's kind of a slam. Look, our Lord gave us this promised land. What's Chemosh given to you? And if he did give it to you, wouldn't you keep it? So whatever the Lord our God takes possession of before us, we will possess it. He's saying, we're going to keep it. It's ours. God gave it to us. And now, are you any better than Balak, the son of Zippor, king of Moab? Did he ever strive against Israel? Did he ever fight against them? While Israel dwelt in Heshbon and its villages, in Aroer and its villages, and in all the cities along the banks of the Arnon for 300 years, why did you not recover them within that time? You know, most people, even the government, you know, will say, well, you know, if a debt hasn't been claimed or filed against you in this period of time, there's a statute of limitations. So he's saying, if your debt against Israel, your claim, had any validity, you had 300 years to claim it. Why didn't you do it then? Therefore, I have not sinned against you, but you wronged me by fighting against me. May the Lord, the judge, render judgment this day between the children of Israel and the people of Ammon. However, the king of the people of Ammon did not heed the words which Jephthah sent him. You know, this length of history, this letter that Jephthah sent to him, was more than just the letter written by a disgraced, illegitimate son. It shows wisdom. It shows training. It shows education. And we don't know exactly when he received that. Maybe he received it at the hands of his father. Maybe his father provided teachers. But either way, he was a good student. He learned. He listened. He watched. He studied. He probably did this his whole life. And remember we talked at the very beginning about the cards that are dealt to you? You talk to good card players and they say there's lots of strategies. You can hope that you get better cards as you trade them in. But so much of it is strategy, and not just playing the cards, but playing the person across from you. Jephthah was learning the game. He was growing, maybe without even intending to. But he was using everything that he had learned from his childhood to his time in the wilderness, being a leader of worthless men. He was taking all of that, and God was using it to save his people. In verse 29, and we don't know if Jephthah had God's Holy Spirit before this, but that we know that then the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah. Some translations will say mightily upon him, so that he is completely led by God. And he passed through Gilead and Manasseh, and passed through Mizpah of Gilead, and through the Mizpah of Gilead, and he advanced toward the people of Ammon. And Jephthah made a vow. Now remember, the Spirit of the Lord is upon him. He's acted very wisely, and he's been a leader of men, albeit a smaller band of outlaws and not the huge army that he's gathering while he's making this trip, calling out all of the Israelites to come to war. But when it comes, push comes to shove, he makes a vow. He tries to make a deal. He makes a vow to the Lord and says, if you will indeed deliver the people of Ammon into my hands, then it will be that whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me, when I return in peace from the people of Ammon, shall surely be the Lord's, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering. Now I think that here, they talk about Jephthah's rash vow. He makes a vow to God. Now, how many times have we in our lives, hopefully not too often we learn, but made a vow like that? God, if you'll just give me this, then I will do this for you. And it almost never works out well. I do know some people who have. They've asked for a blessing and said, Father, if you will bless me with this, then I will help these people with it. I will give back to the church. I will serve these people. And I can tell you the times when I've seen that happen, the growth was explosive. It was incredible how God blessed them. Blessings came that could not be rationalized by man. The success of their endeavors, their business. And as long as they kept that, as long as they kept giving, those blessings never stopped. In fact, sometimes they felt like the blessings were going to drown them. They couldn't give it away fast enough. However, I've also seen other times, and maybe you have too, maybe we've experienced it ourselves, where when we make a promise like that, God, if you'll just give me this, then I'll give you back 30% of my income. Ooh. Well, when the paycheck comes and, wow, I promised an extra 30%. Ouch, that really cuts in here. Or, Father, if you'll just give me this. Maybe it's, I have friends and as young, everybody wants to get married. They think they're in love. Father, if you'll just give me that person. And all of a sudden they get that person. And they're like, oh, bad choice. I didn't know that they were like that. That's a common one. That's a common one because when you're young and in love and it's like, I just want this. And then you grow up a little bit and you go, oh, wow. Hopefully those lessons are learned early and we don't leave lasting scars. But we've all at some point in our life made that kind of a deal with God. However, as a leader of a tribe, as a leader of the armies of Israel, what this shows is a lack of faith on Jephthah's part. God didn't need a promise from Jephthah to deliver Israel from the hands of the Ammonites. Jephthah was a little scared. He'd never done anything this big. He'd never been the leader of his people. And he needed what he felt was like a card up the sleeve. I know that I can win this hand. God will help me, but I want to have a little extra insurance. I'd like to have that ace hidden somewhere on my body. Because that's really what gives me security. That's what gives me comfort. And he makes this vow. And so Jephthah advanced towards the people of Ammon to fight against them. And the Lord delivered them into his hands. And he defeated them from the Aor as far as the Minoth, 20 cities, and to Abel-Karim, with a very great slaughter. Thus the people of Ammon were subdued before the children of Israel. Now this was a battle that we don't know exactly how long it lasted, but when you consider it spread between 20 cities, on the map, that's like 30 square miles. It's a huge area to wage war and to have a battle. This must have been an incredible fight. And they're given victory. And when Jephthah came to his house, remember after this huge victory, they're celebrating. They are on cloud nine. And Jephthah came to his house at Mizpah. There was his daughter, coming out to meet him with timbrels and dancing. And she was his only child. Besides her, he had neither son nor daughter. But he made a promise to God that whoever and whatever came out of his home first would be given to God. And it came to pass when he saw her that he tore his clothes and said, Alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low. You are among those who trouble me, for I have given my word to the Lord, and I cannot go back on it. And so she said to him, My father, if you have given your word to the Lord, do to me according to what has gone out of your mouth, because the Lord has avenged you and your enemies and the people of Ammon. Wow. So here's a father saying, oh, my daughter, I can't go back on this. I have to do it. And here's a girl who must have been like Isaac, who knew what was coming, and says, it's okay. Isaac helped his father gather the wood for the pyre. And then she said to her father, let this thing be done for me. Let me alone for 2 months, that I may go and wander in the mountains and bewail my virginity, my friends, and I. And so he said, go. And notice he doesn't worry about whether she'll keep her word or not, whether she'll come back. And he sent her away for 2 months, and she went away with her friends and bewailed her virginity on the mountains. And it was so at the end of 2 months that she returned to her father, and he carried out his vow with her, which he had vowed. She knew no man, and it became a custom in Israel that the daughters of Israel went 4 days each year to lament the daughter of Jephthah, the Gileadite. So this was Jephthah's rash vow. And this is the one that has the most upset, the most shock, and the most argument. Because we're told that Jephthah would offer up whatever it was, whoever it was, as a burnt offering. And we also know that at that time, in all of the neighboring countries, that this was something that was done. Human sacrifice. It's one of the things that God says he abhorred about them and that they were not to do. So many people say, well, Israel had been so corrupted by that time that they were doing these things. This is one of the reasons why they were in so much trouble, why they needed a strong man, a leader, to rise up and get them back on track. And if he'd really been on those borderlands fighting and living, surrounded by worthless men, then he probably took up those same traditions of sacrificing humans. And seeing as how she was a young virgin, a young girl, they would say that would be the ultimate pagan sacrifice. And all we know is that he did with her as he promised. Now there are also scholars who say that the Hebrew word meaning burnt offering means sacrifice. And I think that this is one of those gray areas where it's not expressly spelled out for us for a reason. God wants to know how we're going to interpret things. It's gray because it's up to us to make the judgment. However, I think if we ask ourselves some questions, such as, what human sacrifice has God ever accepted? Just one. And that sacrifice was for all. It was perfect. And that was the sacrifice of his son. No one else's son, but his. Christ. That is the only blood that we have any example of ever having been shed for atonement of sins. Christ. And if we look at the rest of the Bible, what does God say about human sacrifice? We can look at Leviticus 18. Leviticus 18, verse 21. And you shall not let any of your descendants pass through the fire to Molech, nor shall you profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. So there's one. We flip over another page or two to chapter 20. And we can look at verse 21. Verses 2. Again, you shall say to the children of Israel, whoever of the children of Israel or of any of the strangers who dwells in Israel, who gives any of his descendants to Molech, he shall surely be put to death. The people of the land shall stone him with stones. I will set my face against that man and will cut him off from his people, because he has given some of his descendants to Molech, to defile my sanctuary and profane my holy name. There's other verses. Deuteronomy 12, verse 31. It says it again, that you will not add this into your worship of me, that you will not make your children pass through the fire, that you will not sacrifice human blood to me, that it is an abomination. He repeats it again in Deuteronomy 18 and verse 10. So, has God ever accepted human sacrifice? We have to ask our question again then is, did he actually accept a human sacrifice from Jephthah? And was he okay with it? Or does it mean that she was given to God? We have other examples of those who were given to God into his service. We have 1 Samuel talking about the birth of Samuel. And it's just a book over. A young woman, a wife named Hannah, who could not conceive. And she goes to the tabernacle. In verse 11, and she said, and she made a vow, and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me and not forget your maidservant, but you will give your maidservant a male child, then I will give him to the Lord all of the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head. She's giving her son as an offering to God. Later, when she is blessed with this, she's given this child. She takes him to the temple, or rather to the tabernacle. And she takes him up, in verse 24, and she weaned him, and took him up with her, with three bulls, one ephah of flour, and a skin of wine, and brought him to the house of the Lord in Shiloh. And the child was young. And then they slaughtered a bull and brought the child to Eli. So there is blood, there is a sacrifice, but it's not Samuel. It's a bull. And she said, O my Lord, as your soul lives, my Lord, I am the woman who stood before you here praying to the Lord. For this child I prayed, and the Lord has granted me my petition, which I asked of him. Therefore I also have lent him to the Lord as long as he lives. He shall be lent to the Lord. So they worshiped the Lord there. That's an example of God accepting an offering of a human. But he didn't accept his blood. He accepted a burnt offering in the blood of a bull, but he didn't accept that child's blood. He didn't ask for that. Again, I can't stand here and say with 100% certainty that Jephthah didn't sacrifice his daughter, because it wasn't there. But I can look at the rest of the Bible and see how God looked upon this practice of sacrificing your child. And I can make that decision, that choice of what I'm going to read and what I'm going to believe and think. And that's something that we all have to do. Also, I think there's some other points that lead us to believe that she was given to service to the Lord. Because when she goes away with her friends, she's not bewailing her life She's bewailing her virginity. She's being given to service in the Lord, and she's never going to be able to marry. She's never going to have children. And because she is the only one descendant of Jephthah, his lineage is going to die with her. There are no sons to take his place, no grandsons, no grandchildren, no daughters. It all ends with her. Again, we have to make that judgment ourselves. I also think that, well, I'll get to that later, but we'll continue on because God wasn't done with Jephthah. In chapter 12, Jephthah's defeated the enemies of Israel, but now there are those within Israel who aren't very happy. They're actually not excited about the victory which Israel has had. They're angry. Feel like they got left out of the party. They didn't get a share in the spoils. Verse 12, then the men of Ephraim gathered together, crossed over towards Zephon, and said to Jephthah, why did you cross over to fight against the people of Ammon and did not call us to go with you? We will burn your house down on you with fire. Now remember, this was something that happened. It was a way of killing your enemies without giving them the dignity of combat. Even the Vikings did this. Was that they would lie in wait until the middle of the night, and everyone was asleep. They'd kill the guards, sneak in, and set your houses on fire. And they would position people at the windows and at the doors with spears and swords. And you either stayed in and burned to death, or you ran out and were hacked to death. This was also something that the pagans did. I think it says something about how far Ephraim had fallen away from the rest of Israel, that this was a practice that they had taken up. And Jephthah said to them, my people and I were in a great struggle with the people of Ammon, and when I called you, you did not deliver me out of their hands. I'm kind of remembered or reminded of the story of the little red hen. You know, she gathers up all the wheat and says, I think I'm going to bake some bread. Who wants to plant the wheat with me? Who wants to take care of it? Who wants to pull the weeds and do all the work? And everybody's like, no, no. And, you know, you think of the pig in the yard. No, I'm far too busy. Can't come to the aid and put in my share of the work. But then after the struggle is won, after the bread is baked, boy, that looks pretty good. Boy, I want my portion of it too. And I deserve it. I mean, aren't I part of the family? Except Jephthah's the little red hen. It's like, no, you didn't come when you were called. You didn't help. So why do you deserve a share of the spoils? And he calls them on it. And he tells them, you didn't bother. So when I saw that you would not deliver me, I took my life in my own hands and crossed over against the people of Ammon, and the Lord delivered them into my hand. Again, he's giving credit to the Lord for the delivery, for the victory. Why have you come up against me this day to fight against me? He's reminding them that I have been the servant of the Lord. So if you're attacking me, then you're also attacking God. This was his plan. This was his victory. By confronting me, you're confronting him and what he did. Now Jephthah gathered together all the men of Gilead and fought against Ephraim. And the men of Gilead defeated Ephraim because they said, you Gileadites are fugitives of Ephraim, among the Ephraimites and among the Manassites. The Gileadites seized the fords. This is the crossing places and the rivers and streams. They seized the fords of the Jordan before the Ephraimites arrived. And when any Ephraimite who escaped said, let me cross over, the men of Gilead would say to him, are you an Ephraimite? And if he said no, they would say to him, then say the word Shibboleth. And he would say, Siboleth, for he could not pronounce it right. This was something that he'd been raised in a way that he couldn't pronounce those words, Shibboleth or Siboleth. He pronounced it a different way. Just like when you talk to people who grew up with a different tongue, maybe they grew up speaking Japanese, they have a really hard time saying our words. Or just like us, who we're supposed to all be speaking English, have a really hard time rolling our R's like the Scottish do. It makes you stand out. You really can't help it. And this is how they knew that they were Ephraimites. And the word that they were having them say literally means stream. So they would bring them down to the river, and they'd say, "What's that? Say it. What's the word for this?" And they couldn't do it. And so they fell into their hands. And then they would take him and kill him at the fords of the Jordan. And there fell at that time 42,000 Ephraimites. Now many people look at this as a horrific slaughter. Except every single one of those men who was coming down to the ford to cross over was coming down to make war on Gilead against Jephthah, the servant of God. It was more than just a random butchery. This was God's plan. He could have caused a plague to sweep through and wipe them all out, but it was important that this was done by the Gileadites and by Jephthah. And after this, Jephthah judged Israel 6 years, which is a short time compared to most of the judges. And then Jephthah the Gileadite died and was buried among the cities of Gilead. Now again, we can look at Jephthah, just like we can look at any of the men in the Bible whom God used. And because all of their faults and all of their sins are put out there for us to see, because that's really where the lessons are, we tend to read them very harshly. Most of the commentaries that I looked at, well, they really don't paint him in a very good picture. He was just this scum of the earth mercenary, the son of a prostitute, who God decided to use. And he sacrificed his daughter. What a barbarian. How horrible. And they don't read him any other way. Except we also know that he's listed amongst the heroes of faith in Hebrews 11. Just like all the other men who were looked down upon. The men, the women, those who were harlots, prostitutes, who are in the lineage of Christ, whom God chose to use, not because they were born with a silver spoon in their mouth or they had the full royal flesh, but because he saw the potential that they had, because they weren't born with all of that, because they weren't given it, but they developed it over a period of time and they grew into it. Admittedly, maybe I choose to read these people in a more romantic way. But I also hope I'm reading them in a way that God will read me. Because I don't want to be judged as harshly. Just like we can look at someone else and say, and judge them without really knowing their heart or why they react the way that they do. So how do we read these examples in the Bible, servants of God? Are we going to be like the Ephraimites and criticize them and downplay who they were, talk against them? Remember what happened to Miriam when she talked against her brother, Moses, the servant of God? I don't want to be judged that way. I think if we look at him, and we can speculate, even I think that it's, we look at the man that he was. In a time when men took multiple wives because they had the strength, the power, and the money to do it, not because it was a good thing, but they did it because they could. Jephthah only had one daughter. Many of the other judges had 70 sons, like Gideon, or 30 sons and 30 daughters, because they had multiple wives and wealth. Well, Jephthah had power. He had money. He could have afforded it, but I surmise that he only had one wife. One wife who could only give him one daughter. Not even a male heir to whatever it was that he could possess. And I wonder if his childhood, being the son of a harlot, being brought up in a home with multiple wives, had not made him decide that I'm not going to do that. Again, I wasn't there with him. I didn't know the man. But if he made it into Hebrews 11, doesn't that kind of make sense? Isn't that the hero that we want him to be? That those cards that he was dealt, that horrible hand, this is your position and status in life. The label that you're going to be addressed with, he was able to overcome. That same label that technically was given to Christ. An illegitimate son. Brethren, this is one of the reasons why I love reading the characters of the Bible, especially later on those who are listed in Hebrews 11. Because we're told that they did not start out as heroes of faith, but that they grew into it. They became heroes of faith. I find that encouraging because I know that God's not done with me yet. That wherever we start, whatever hand we're dealt, we have the potential of so much more. Of being heroes of faith. Of having that story take part in our hearts and in our lives. And to be able to be called a hero of faith. Those who have obtained a good testimony through faith. That's where we want to be. That the word that reaches God's ears, the prayers of the saints, is a good one. And frankly, when you start out with a bad hand, look at all the potential. Everything to gain. And I believe that's who God calls. And so as we look at these men, and today we've looked at Jephthah, his story that started with his mother, his father, we can find encouragement for ourselves. Because we may sit and ask, why did God choose me? Maybe because we're starting out with less. And he doesn't see where we've begun or where we're at now. He sees the future that we have, the potential to be greater and to be more. And just like Jephthah, whose name literally meant to be set free, whatever hurdles, whatever burdens we see before us, God will name us as free sons and daughters.